Session number 12163, Reel 2.
Mr. Fitzjohn, Reel 2.
And there was some shelling at the wire, and in the meantime, Rommel must have realised that he was rapidly running out of supplies and things were going bad. So he hastily decamped and vanished west. So we advanced up the desert. We went to Sidi Orme. From there, we joined the New Zealanders at Fort Capuzzo. And from there, we chased after Rommel. We did 250 mile up the desert in our Matildas without a break. A Matilda, I think, could do about 10 miles for 2 days, and the third day it had to be maintained. But our Matildas, I think we travelled 250 miles without a mechanical breakdown, which was a marvellous advert for our fitters. I'll give them the due. It wasn't the Remy in those days. It was the LAD, the Light Aid Detachment of the Ordnance Corps. And
you were a driver yourself?
Yes.
A driver of Matilda?
Yeah.
And what was it like driving Matilda?
Well, we had the huge speed of 15 mile an hour flat out. I think I once got 17 out of one I had. And it was 26 tons fully laden, which you appreciate is a dinky toy nowadays, isn't it? I was at Catterick on the Challenger 2 a few months ago, the new Challenger 2, and I just couldn't believe it. We had two, they were either AEC or Leyland bus engines, actually, in the Tilda. Two diesel engines. They were diesel, luckily. So we didn't have the fear of the, as we call, brewing up, as all the other tanks did, the petrol tanks. But they were easy enough to drive. And, of course, the main thing was that you can do all these different things in Syria. I'll give you an example. The periscope on a Matilda. We used to have dozens of them laid around spare prisms. And if one got broke, all you did was simply unclip it and pull it out, put another one in. But that's in theory. You can do it blindfolded. It takes about 3 seconds. But in practice, you get a hit on the outside of the tank. Naturally, the metal becomes all twisted. You try to pull the prism through and you can't. So you have the happy job of, do I open up and put my head out, or do I drive blind? Or am I getting on too far ahead?
No, that's fine.
Because that's what happened to me in, well, the Battle of the Cauldron. Sidra Ridge.
Later.
Yes, that's what I say. It's later. At the moment, I've advanced. I don't know where I am now.
You said you were driving up the desert.
Up the desert, yes. Yeah, well, we reached a place called Carmusa, which is south of Gazala. And we joined up with our friends, the Indian Division. Off and on, we were nearly always with the 4th Indian Division. But owing to the shortage of tanks, you could serve with 3 divisions in a day. It sounds ridiculous, I know, but it was with South Africans, Poles, you didn't know who you was with, dashing from one lot to the other. But anyhow, while this was happening, Bardia and Hellfire Pass were still in German hands. That was approximately 250 mile behind us. And the 44th Battalion and us were sent back to capture Hellfire Pass and Bardia. Well, the job of Bardia fell to the 44th Battalion, who actually did a moonlight attack, a night attack with Matildas, which at that time was something phenomenal. And they captured Bardia and released quite a lot of prisoners of war, among them quite a lot of our regiments. And we had the job of Hellfire Pass. Now, I think that is the only time I've had a bit of apprehension and fear, because it was noted Hellfire Pass, I think, was littered with British tanks from previous battles, the battle axe and all those. And the Matildas, which had been knocked out there, the Germans had dug the turrets in as pillboxes. And as I say, we even got to the state of getting on the start line, ready to advance on a Hellfire Pass. And the news came through that they'd surrendered. And I think that was one of the happiest moments of my life, that I was apprehensive that time. So we were saved the trouble of Hellfire Pass. And then from there we had to go back again up the desert, the same tanks just about falling to bits. And we went through Derna and on to Gazala. Let me think. Yes, and then, in the meantime, things had calmed down and the line became static, the Gazala line, from Bir Hakeim to Gazala on the coast.
Just before we take it any further, I'd like to go back to one thing that I think we've left out, which was earlier in, I think it was November 1941, you came across an abandoned lager of the 1st Armoured Division.
Should I tell you?
If you can relate that incident, please.
Well, after Rommel had retreated and we advanced up the desert, we came to, it was like a film set actually, a perfect lager of vehicles. And we found out later it was one of the echelons of the 1st Army Division. 1st Armoured Division, sorry. And there were all these trucks, jeeps, motorbikes. There was half-eaten meals. There was dixies on. People had been brewing up, half full of water, and not a human being in sight. During the flap, they must have all piled on different trucks and vanished. And we just happened to be the first troops when we went forward again to reach this. And now, I'm sticking my neck out now. I'll be on a court-martial, probably hung, drawn and quartered. But in one of the trucks, it was loaded with two-pounder ammunition, which we all used then, and we were offloading the two-pounder ammunition onto our trucks and different things. And we came across one ammo box, and it was very light. And when we opened it, the first thing we saw was tins of red, white and blue coffee was the brand. I can vividly remember them, red, white and blue coffee in cylindrical, like the old cocoa tins of years ago. Under that, I may be wrong, I think there's a few bars of chocolate and different things. And then a box containing, which nowadays is nothing I know, but I don't know, something like just short of 300 Egyptian pounds, which was the currency we used, which you appreciate is a fortune. And to cut a long story short, the sergeant and six of us decided the best thing to do was to share it out into seven equal amounts and forget all about the incident. So from then onwards, right up to the time of me being taken prisoner of war in the following June, I never drew a penny's pay or a piaster in pay. We never drew any pay. Not that we needed it in the desert, but occasionally we used to get a nappy truck came up with some, and you could buy things off them. So we did very well. We used to buy in bulk and much the envy of all the rest of the lads, where's the money come from? Which we never told, I can't recall ever telling anybody, until after the war when I've told different people. And the twist of the story is, when I was taken prisoner of war, all the records had been destroyed at Tobruk before the British evacuated Tobruk and went to El Alamein. So of course, all the back pay which I was due to, I never received. So the money I received from the first armoured div covered that. So that was the story of the first armoured div's canteen.
What were living conditions like for the troops in the desert?
Well, I found it good. Well, I'll put it this way. My favourite meat nowadays, offer me what you like, is corned beef. And we lived solidly on corned beef and biscuits for months and months on an end, along with tea. In fact, we used to chop the hammer with a hammer, hammer the biscuits up and make what we call burgoo, or a porridge, and sweeten it with captured Italian mineral waters and things. But we actually lived on bully beef and biscuits. Occasionally you'd get a tin of bacon between a troop, which was about a pound of bacon for 12 of you. So you tossed up which tank had it, and often a small amount of jam. But we literally lived on bully beef and biscuits, and we were healthy on it. And I never tired of it, and I never have. I can still eat bully beef in preference to a beef steak or you name it.
And did you get constipated?
No, oh no. We used to just, morning or night, just wander off with a shuffle. And an amusing thing with that is you could go with your shovel and select a nice spot in the desert and have a bowel movement, but when you looked round, the bowel movement had vanished. There used to be a kind of beetle with the huge... You used to chop it up into pieces and scurry off with it. Well, I don't know what they lived on before we came there. They were hundreds of miles from anywhere in the desert, but they appeared like miraculously the minute you went to spend do your business.
How quickly would they appear?
Practically while you were, within a few minutes. And another thing was, you could be... If you look at the map of the desert, you'll find lots of places, but they aren't places. It's a cairn of stones, or a burial place of Sidi somebody thousands of years ago, or probably a dried-up well. And you could be literally 200 miles from anywhere in the middle of the Western Desert, and you stopped your tanks on an evening, and within half an hour, a gentleman would appear sitting on the behind of a donkey wanting to swap your eggs for tea. Where he'd come from, where he went, how he knew he was there, don't ask me, but it used to happen.
So he wanted the tea?
Yes.
But he'd give you eggs?
Yeah, but I'd like to know where he came from and where he went. And on hindsight, I wonder if the eggs were snake eggs we were eating. But we used to enjoy them when we got them. and they'd often also ask for a piece of paper. You had to write that he was a good chap, how he'd helped the English. Always asked for a pass, as they called it. And he'd ask the Germans the same, I suppose. He had a pocket full. And we used to make him one out, used to say, whatever happened, do not trust this. But it's illegitimacy to robbing one of the old restaurant and give it much thanking and salaming and the way he used to go with it, clutching his pass. But, how did I get onto that?
Well, did you ever have any problems with the inhabitants of the desert?
No, oh no. Well, we very, very seldom saw any, only on occasions like that.
And what about other creatures apart from the dung beetles?
Oh, they used to be the desert rats, naturally. And it's a funny thing. I happen to horror, but I dislike snakes. I do not like snakes. And on a night, we'd be travelling along, and when it got to be what we used to call, half an hour before sundown, we were all dispersed in the desert. We used to form the old English lager, like soft-skinned vehicles in the centre, surrounded by a ring of tanks, so that we just got into this lug about the time night fell, and the next morning, half hour before first light, we dispersed again, you see, ready for any aircraft coming. But, this is
you were talking about snakes.
My brain cell. So we used to stop in the desert on a night. We'd get the tank sheet out, clear any boulders out the way, lay the tank sheet out, the four of us crawl, the last man, pull the sheet, the tarpaulin right over us, and that was our bed for the night. Well, I could guarantee whenever we stopped, if there was 50 boulders, it got to be a joke with my crew, that they used to refer to me as Fitz, naturally, my name is. They say, move one of the boulders, Fitz, and let's start clearing out the way to put to bed down. And whichever boulder I picked, there'd be a snake under it. I could go to one and say, no, no, this one. And I don't mean every time, but you could practically guarantee. And what we used to do, Jimmy, my wireless operator on my tank, he used to have an empty bully beef tin with petrol in it, just throw it on and throw a match in and destroy the snake. No cruelty, it was over in a second. But that's about. And on rare occasions, there were a kind of a deer or antelope you often saw in the distance, but these stories I've read in books of officers chasing them in jeeps and belting away with 303s, I'm afraid I've never come across anything like that.
What about the desert rats? Can you tell me about those?
Well, yeah, they were amusing little things, but they didn't do any harm to anybody. And
in what way were they so amusing?
Well, a funny little animal. Yeah, they were something absolutely exotic, foreign to us. You know, we were used to seeing mice and things in England. These were like a miniature kangaroo, more or less. A small, fairy, nice little things.
What did they do when you saw them?
Nothing. In fact, I think a lot of them were cheeky enough to be running round the tracks when you was often in a lager on the night. You know, you could hear little scuttlings and scurryings about, but I say, I didn't have much to do with desert rats. It's just become famous all of a sudden now, hasn't it? All talking about the desert rats and the Gulf and everything, but I never bothered much with them.
Did you like being in the desert?
I did. It was good. It was a good, healthy life, I thought. I can't explain the peace on the night, how marvellous it was in the sky. I used to enjoy the desert.
But were you plagued with flies?
Oh, yes, well, you always had flies. That was, you couldn't do anything about that. And I know at times we'd manage to get some petrol, and we used to take off we only used to wear a pair of shorts, rare occasions a shirt and shorts, and now boots. Just take our shirt and shorts off, throw them in the petrol, throw them on the sand, and in 10 minutes put them back on again, and they were perfectly laundered, no smell, dry. Very hygienic life. Truthfully, as you can imagine, we never washed or shaved. We were pretty filthy looking people.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with you going into the Ghazala line for 3 months. Can you pick the story up from
there, well, please? That was, I think, for about... You'll have to look this up. I should imagine for 2 months the Ghazala line was static. Germans at one side, us on the other. And apart from the occasional shell in the odd Stuka, it was very quiet, and we were just doing nothing, more or less. We sometimes used to have the infantry regiments come and look at our tanks, and we used to go and have a look at their equipment. And I remember one occasion I was showing one of the infantry lads the driving seat of my tank. We were both bent over. The gunner was in the turret showing these lads his 2-pounder, and need I tell you that suddenly one of the infrared lad was, he was going to show him how to sight his gun through the telescope and everything. There's a huge roar over our head and a 2-pounder went flying over.
What went flying over?
A 2-pounder shell about 3 or 4 inches over my head and the other chap out. I'll never forget that. And we could literally see it skidding across over the desert. Luckily, it didn't hit anything. But that was one amusing incident about where we were quiet. And then the only, apart from, I say, the odd shelling and the odd Stuka raid, we went out on a patrol, my troop. That was 3 tanks through the wire, and we went about 10 mile. I really don't know what we were doing. I suppose somebody higher up knew. Went about 10 mile. All we saw was a German wireless car and an armoured car, and they scooted off. And we returned back through the wire to our camp. And when we got back, we found out that about 10 mile north of us, I think it was more than a troop of our tanks had gone out, along with 25-pounders and infantry, doing the same as us, and they'd been surrounded by 60 German tanks, like the old cowboy and Indian fashion, gradually knocking out our tanks until in the end everyone was either killed or captured. I think a Captain Carnell, I think it was, I stand corrected, and his driver hid in a disused well, if I'm not mistaken, and they're about the only two who got back out of that. So, once again, luck was on my side. The 60 tanks happened to be 10 mile north of us instead of waiting for us. But as I say, it was pretty quiet at the Gazala line, and then the big thing happened. Rommel decided to advance. And I've blanked my mind, absolute chaos it was. You didn't know what you was doing. But the most vivid thing that happened to me was what is known as the Battle of the Cauldron, or Sidra Ridge. And this ridge was held by the Germans. And what tanks remained of the 1st Army Tank Brigade and the 7th Battalion were all combined together to attack this Sidra Ridge. And we advanced at first light against Sidra Ridge under a smoke. The artillery fired a smoke screen. When we got through the smoke, when it had dispersed, we found ourselves in the middle of a minefield, which no one knew was there. And sighted all along the front were dug-in 88mm guns, which just at leisure started potting off our tanks, like in a shooting gallery. So, let me get this right. Most of B squadron tanks were knocked out on the minefield, and our A squadron attempted to move round the minefield and came to where we were on the right flank. And as we all started to try and get past the minefield, the best part of the 21st Panzer Div came on our right flank and started belting away at us. So we were in the nice position of having a minefield in front of us, 88 belting away at us, and Panzers on our right, and we were in the middle of it all. And people have asked, well, not people, I mean different, I don't talk about the army much to outsiders, but I've been talking to the lads often, and they've said, what's it like, what's happened to so-and-so, and what was it like? And I said, well, you don't know anything that's happening. The next tank to me was our troop leader, Lieutenant Coulton, he got his head blown off. And years afterwards, I had a letter from a Don Feathersney, an author of military books, asking me how he got killed. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I can't tell you. The fact that you're too busy looking after yourself in your own tank, you can't be. All you're seeing is your small piece of the battlefield. There's another, well, originally another 69 tanks scattered about, but all I saw was ours. And as I said, the Panzers came on our right, and suddenly you could hear the, I assume, the 75 and 50 millimetre shells banging into our right-hand side. And I think the first shell that hit us, and I was showered with aluminium paint, the tank inside all painted with silver, and I can remember a scattering of silver paint. And I have to think now, I don't want to tell it wrong. And then a shot came and smashed my periscope. Well, I was well trained in things like that. All I had to do was unclip the periscope, pull the prism out, and had dozens of spares about, and shove a new one in. But unfortunately, the fact that a shell's hit the front of your tank and the casing around the periscope, all the metal's twisted up, and you cannot pull the broken prism out. And I was in the horrible position of, did I open up and put my hand out, or look out, or what to do? And we had another big bang, and the intercom went from the commander to the crew. So I was driving blind, and I couldn't get any orders or instructions. And I can remember turning round, and I got hold of the wireless operator. He loaded the 2-pounder, that was Jimmy Campbell from Scotland, and shook him and made him understand to bend down and explain what had happened. And from there onwards, I was getting steered by a kick in my left shoulder or my right shoulder, as he could. Yeah. And it got absolutely chaotic. You don't know what was happening. And then suddenly, we must have got a hit in the turret, and the turret was jammed. Well, when the turret of a tank's jammed, it's useless. You can only just fire wherever the gun's pointing. And again, I should have been told to reverse out of action to keep the heaviest armour of the tank facing forward. But I can vividly remember getting told, and I was turned right round, and away we came back. Well, as we was coming back out of it, I opened up the driver's hatch. Then I knew I was comparatively safe. And I think my heart was in my boots. There was, as far as the eye could see, was Matilda's on fire and knocked out. And I passed one. There was our squadron leader was laid out on the side of it. And I can't tell you just what did happen. We got back to a ridge, and at the roll call there was 12 of us back out of the 70, and I can remember going back, the four of us from the tank. We left the tank and we went back to one of our three tunners, and they made us tea and that, and one of the fitters came over. I remember this vividly, and he said, "Do you mind if I drive your tank, Fitz?" So I said, "You can do what you like with it." And so he must have manned that tank for a while we were in this truck. And I truthfully can't remember how I got back to that tank.
What stage were you in?
There's nothing wrong with me, but it must have been some reaction.